So this period of time, this period of inquiry again, I'll take a couple of minutes to give the general outline, a small reminder. Anyone who didn't come up for a previous inquiry is invited to come, and with the inquiry time, maybe some questions arising from your time, from your days here, from the meditations and practices, instructions and talks, etc. Maybe sometimes there are areas of concern or of interest for you, and there is an interest in the Dharma perspective on things, and that may be possible. With the inquiry, it may last a few minutes or longer. At any time, the person who's speaking can say thank you to, or myself, to bring it to a closure. 2 or 3 minutes of shared silence together, and then I'll say anyone, another person may wish to come, so that we're alternating from the inquiry and the exploration back into the silence for 2 or 3 minutes, then back into the inquiry over the hour-long period. Remembering, of course, that the intention is to contribute to calm and insight, some understanding for all of us without exception. It is helpful and beneficial in the inquiry to give the fullness of listening, and therefore it means listening outwardly to people having a dialogue, and inwardly as well, to see what the responses are in the process of the listening. The inquiry time may last a few minutes or much longer, whatever seems necessary, and as I just mentioned, the thank you is the signal for some closure on the theme. We have, as per usual, the recorders, and if it's okay with you, it's recorded, but if so, then it's available to anyone who wishes to listen, and if you prefer it's not recorded, then I'll just switch it off and stays in the silence. So anyone who has anything, who was not sitting here for the previous inquiry, very welcome to come and speak.
Anyone who wants to speak in Hebrew,
oh yes, and if you prefer to speak in Hebrew, there'll be a translator for that. Okay. With the recording?
Yeah, okay.
Is that right? Okay, yes.
So, is it work? So I was talking with Iran,
yes,
this afternoon.
Mm.
I wanted to know what you think about the subject of the incarnation, because I didn't quite understood what you were thinking about it.
What did Iran tell you? Let's see whether we wouldn't want to confuse you. So tell us what you remember. It may not be what Iran said, but
what Iran said?
Yeah, yeah. What did you ask? I'm curious.
No, but the reason that I'm asking you is I want to get as much answers as I can.
Yeah, exactly. But if Iran said exactly the same as me, whatever, then I don't have to talk. So I'm still curious. Iran will watch his sensations as you. Go on. What did you ask him?
Iran said it doesn't matter.
Oh, very good. All right, that's what he said. Very good answer. So you want me to give another one, do you? Is there any background? It's a valuable question. Is there any background to the question? What incarnation? What does the word mean for you? Explain what you understand by this word, incarnation.
What I understand is that after this life,
yes,
you kind of get another life in the another. As another human being, animal, or
all right.
I don't know.
So this view is certainly gets expressed. It's probably the most commonly held view in Eastern religions. I would have to say. It's a commonly held part of the Eastern belief system. What's your own feeling or view about reincarnation or rebirth? What your voice? What's your voice?
I think I believe that you're not here for just 80 or 90 years.
If you're lucky.
Yeah.
Or unlucky, depending. Anyway.
I feel like there must be some continuation. But I'm not sure. That's why I'm asking.
No. I mean, there are various voices around. I'll keep asking for a moment. And some will say, yes, definitely. And some Buddhist traditions, Tibetan most strongly, I would say, insist on it. One is developing one's practice over many, many, many lifetimes towards Buddhahood. So in some of the major Tibetan traditions, that's a standard viewpoint. The Dalai Lama is the reincarnation of previous Dalai Lamas. It's the view which has been adopted in Theravada countries as well. There's recollections of past lives and future lives, etc. And some may have that belief. And some will say, it doesn't matter. Having the belief for yourself should be or could be or must be that. Would that be or is that helpful for you? There is a belief. I don't believe I just have one life for X number of years, that there are future lives there. Is that belief helpful for you? And if so, in which way is it helpful?
This inquiry is getting very hard.
I gave the health warning a couple of days ago. I tried to avoid answering, redirect the question back without you realizing.
So what was the question?
The question is a belief, since we can't prove it, I'll give you my view in a moment, but is a belief about rebirth helpful for you?
Yes.
Which way is it helpful? It's a very open question. There's no shadows. In which way is a belief in future lives helpful for you?
Mm-hmm. It is helpful because you can do good stuff, good things, good actions,
yes,
and you don't have to see the results right away, because you know that maybe it won't happen in this life, but in the other way.
Alright. Okay, fair enough. So sometimes in developing deep and beautiful qualities of the inner life, there is a certain faith here that even if the benefits are not really arising during the flow of this life, then if life keeps coming back, like the seasons, you know, it keeps renewing itself and starting up again in different form, then the benefits will come in a future life. And genuinely, I agree, that could be supportive. What if it was proved, speculation, that future life and those kind of reincarnation, rebirth, if it was proved, there's not a drop of truth in it. It's the ego's desire for continuity. How would that affect you if it was proven? This is not the case, it's just ego wanting to live longer in another form, and there's no truth in it. How would you respond to that?
I think I would accept it.
But you would accept it?
Yeah.
But then you do all these practices and all this, and then you say, Mike, wow, I'm doing all these practices, putting all this time and effort and energy into it, but the fruit, the benefit, isn't coming in this lifetime, because the life is too short, or it gets cut off. Would putting all the efforts in be a bit of a waste of time, because you never got the fruits? You planted the seeds, but the fruits never came, and there's no future life for them to come in. Now where are you? I'm only asking questions. It's the easiest job in the whole place, I have to say.
I think I would have to accept it, because I have no other choice.
You got it. You have to accept it, there's no other choice.
Yeah.
Some of us, to give a small parallel, some of us love the earth and love life and feel concern at human beings' relationship to life. And wish to see our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and families and the beings that are not yet in this world come into a world where there is love and safety and care and an environment which can support all. So some of us in this room, and myself included, are actually planting seeds. We're planting lots of seeds over the days here. And the planting of those seeds, it means also that the probability we won't see the fruits, because we'll be dead, we'll be gone, and the other generations of the good efforts of those who love life and are committed to it will pass out of this world, but seeds, and perhaps sometimes in our practices, in our commitments, we do it because we feel it's important. We plant seeds, we may never see the trees and the flowers that come.
So your answer is that you don't believe that.
Not at all. No, that's not my answer. But I can understand the conclusion you might draw there. There's gotten quite a lot of dialogue. So, to give an example, the teachers know here, Stephen Batchelor, he's reflected on this a lot. So, he's a very fine writer, a good friend of mine, nearly 40 years, and a fine author and speaker, and has been to Israel a couple of times, maybe two or three times. And he has a wealth of tradition. He has firmly come down with the view of disbelief in rebirth and reincarnation. So he used to have an agnostic position, now he's absolutely no to it. That's Stephen's view. It's not my view, but it is his view. I'll take the Buddha for a moment. There's a voice in all of this. In one of the great discourses of the of his, called the Kalama Discourse, the Kalama, a group of people, he said, if there is rebirth, there will be benefits if we do our practice. If there is rebirth. And if there isn't any rebirth, there will still be benefits. What's your response?
I still have no answer for my question.
It's provisional. Provisional. It's allowing for the possibility either way. Is that clear? It allows. If there is rebirth, there will be benefits for those who live a healthy and wise and loving life.
So you have the same answer as Iran?
No. All respect to Iran, but no. It says the view, it doesn't matter. That's the view. I'm saying it does matter.
Okay.
Apologies, Iran. I'm saying it is one of the areas to really give consideration to, and to keep the dialogue inwardly open. I do think it's important. Basically, there are four kinds of views. There may be others, but the four that come to my mind. There is the scientific materialistic view. The view is one life. We are born, we die, it's complete extinction, that's it. Over, bas, gadam, bogia. As the if you know Hindi, you know what I mean. And that's one view. But it's a view. Neither provable nor disprovable. It's a view. And it's in the scientific, materialistic environment. There is the view, the religious view. After you die, according to your behavior, or according to what you believe, God, Allah, Jehovah, the book, the prophet, the Son of God, or whatever it might be, that would determine what happens to you when you die. Heaven, hell, I think they dreamt up some in between, limbo, etc. Cover everything, I suppose. And there are, not to underestimate, the millions of people in the world who believe in this view. Not to underestimate it. And though Europeans, it's only down to about 5% at the moment, but the United States is very fundamentalist on this view, I have to say. Very, very. And the third view is reincarnation. And reincarnation is that there is a self, and the self leaves the body and it moves and enters another body. So this is what is meant by reincarnation. So it keeps reincarnating itself. And that's a common view, especially in Hindu culture, Hindu tradition there. And then there is rebirth. The interesting thing is, the word rebirth does not appear out of the mouth of the Buddha. Strictly speaking, the word is re-becoming. So, to use the metaphorical language for a moment, you and I and we are like waves in the ocean. We are waves, small waves, and waves in the ocean of life. And for the waves to arise, it requires a force. And the force brings up the wave, and the force brings up the wave, and the force brings up the wave. And these waves keep reforming, keep recycling, like the seasons, keeps going round and round and round.
Like
the butterfly. And if we go deeper into life, we might lose the identity of being the wave. We might see deeper. We might free ourselves from this limitation, which is born from grasping all of this as I, me and my. Little bit like the butterfly liberates itself from the cocoon. That's what we're interested in. And the movement of life and the expressions of it, all I can say with that is keep heart and mind open. It's a foolish person who comes down with an absolute position on these things. Absolute. I think the scientific materialistic view seems a terribly small view, but the idea of thinking about the future and speculating about it, you know, making merit now for future lives, I think just misses the point. Yeah. Any responses?
Thank you.
Very nice response. Thank you. A couple of quiet minutes and then... Anytime. Let's take a seat. With the recording, easy? Okay, nice.
No problem.
Okay.
So in your talk a few days ago,
yes.
At the end you mentioned that something about trusting in the mystery.
Trusting in the mystery,
right.
Did I?
Oh dear. And I have no idea what that means.
No, not me. Go on, carry on. All right.
Trust.
What did I say?
Yeah. Trust in general and trusting in the mystery, I don't understand.
Did I use trust in mystery? I might have done. I'll bow to your memory and ignore my own. The element of trust is I break away from the past and I don't know what the future is, and I'm in the state of the unknown, and it's a complete mystery to me what might happen, what might be the outcome of this trust, which is nothing clear to me to trust in. I break away from the past. No idea what will be the outcome of the decision. I'm in this unknown. I don't want to fill my mind up with speculation or anxiety. I'm going to trust that perhaps in this unknown, which I'm in, whatever that might be about, and even though it's some kind of mystery to me what it is, I'm going to rest in it. This is called trust. It's free from anxiety. It's free from fear. It's free from projections. And I'm willing just to be in it, like some huge empty vessel. This is what it's meant, or what I mean by it at the moment. What would you like to say?
I don't know if I have anything to add.
Oh.
Or, but so it sounds like you're simply saying that trust in the unknown means trust that things can be different than they presently are or have been.
Not quite.
Okay.
Good. Because sometimes, and I'm sure many of us in different circumstances, sometimes with the dynamics of life, it's, as it were, the outer, and it, or sometimes it's the inner. What I mean by that, life can impact on us, and it completely throws us right out of our comfort zone. Sometimes everything that we put together, we built our life up on, all the foundations, all the securities, all that we've been committed to, and then something happens to us and it totally shakes up the life. And then we're completely in the unknown. Sometimes it's not so much from the outer, but it comes from the inner. It may not be easy even to ourselves to explain what it is that makes us break away from an event or events. We may not be able to explain to ourselves or to others. Others may think we've made a completely foolish or wrong decision. And then we ask ourselves, what are you going to do now? What am I going to do now? Others say, what are you going to do now? You've dropped out of this, you've stepped out of that, you've cut that off, you've let go of that. And sometimes all the heart can say is, actually, I really don't know. It could be a good place to be, couldn't it?
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. All right. So all that we can say in that kind of mystery for us, I know what was. That I know. And I've been cast out of what was. By other, by life circumstance, or by intentionality. I've been cast out of that. So I only know what was. I don't know what will be. And I'm right there between the two. And in this sense of the unknown is one of the most challenging aspects of life for a human to live with. When we can't live with it, fear and anxiety will certainly emerge. For sure it will emerge when we can't live with it. And sometimes life throws the unknown at us. So, any experiences in your good life, sir?
In regard to the unknown?
Yeah, and
all the time.
All the time. Unlikely, but anyway, I know what you mean. So, what happens when you can't rely on the past? You don't know what the future is? What happens for you in those times of living with the unknown?
Like you said, I feel anxious.
You feel anxious?
Afraid.
Mm. Does your God give you any support?
What's God?
I shouldn't be asking you. You're the you've got the uniform. You know, I've got the non-God uniform.
You also have a uniform.
Eh?
I don't have an answer.
Don't have an answer. All right. Sweet. But
if I had an answer, then I maybe wouldn't be up here.
All right. Okay. But sometimes, to be fair to religious, that when the unknown is deep and rather dark,
mm-hmm.
and it can be, and we're really just in the depth of the unknown, and we have no idea what or where. Sometimes the religious life, some people can give some support at that time. The G.O.D., so to speak, can be a kind of support, a reference point, a small anchor in the ocean of uncertainty. Do you find yourself either with prayer or with thought or the book or whatever, using God to give comfort in the unknowns?
I have.
You have.
But I don't.
But you don't. Is it because God didn't listen? And you think, well, he's not listening, forget him, so I'm not going to do it anymore? Or is it, or something else? Just a question.
It's not a matter of gut. I'm going to try to answer that as succinctly as I can. So your question is, do I not rely on God because God didn't give me what I want?
Yes.
I don't know if God, in my personal experience, certainly, mm-hmm. and also in general, mm-hmm. also including the book, mm-hmm. and other people's lives,
yes.
I don't see people necessarily receiving what they want, or receiving what they deserve, or yes. seeing sort of the fruits of no. their action, as the mm-hmm. previous conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see God working as a vending machine. You put in your quarter of prayer, and then you get it back.
Yeah,
you
right.
get candy
good.
Back.
All right. Okay.
I have to admit that in some sense I used to.
Yes.
But clearly mm. both were.
No.
My life, the book,
no.
and other people's lives don't actually play that out.
In some circles that you will know better than I, your words are quite, to the orthodoxy, would be considered very radical, because you're not making Yahweh the reference point, are you? Yet you're wearing the, what do you call that word?
Tzekiba.
Tzekiba.
So
and the tassels.
They're called tzitzis.
What are they called?
Tzitzit.
Tzitzit.
Or tzitzis. Depending on
yes.
where you come from.
Well, here it's sit, but anyway. <we're> So, what does it represent? Because it's a symbolic expression of some inner life, isn't it? Which is beautiful. You know, but what does it represent if your relationship to God seems to be rather quiet?
It is.
It is. So what does the what is the symbolic reference point?
They're just things.
Just things.
So at
you're
various
more Buddhist
times
than the Buddhists.
What's that?
You're more Buddhist than the Buddhists.
I'm also not Orthodox.
All right, no.
And I mean, I can give you various theologies, but I think, yeah, I if
yeah,
you
yeah.
want me to give you various
no, no, no,
theologies
no, no,
within
no, no,
Judaism,
no, no,
I'm happy
no, no,
to
no,
give
no,
a...
No, I've heard them.
There are theologies that within Judaism that support my belief. There are theologies
sure.
that are against it.
No, I know, it's a broad, and it's a great
it's a
credit.
It's a complicated tradition.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good it's a good spirit for that. So, in sometimes holding the religious world, shall we say, lightly, means we may have to live a little bit more, of course, with our inner life, not have too much of an external referent called God or called
mm-hmm.
the book or whatever there. In the coming back to the earlier point, in the question, in the being with the unknown, although it's uneasy, is there anything really valuable and deeply important about the experience of the unknown for you?
course. I mean, the unknown is a place of possibility.
All right. Nice. Okay. So the unknown, I'm fully with you, is a place of possibility. It's pregnant with possibility. That is, sometimes we're living our life so habitually, might be comfortable, but habitually, we lose sight of the incredible potential that the unknown and the break with the known can bring. What kind of possibility comes to mind to you? What kind of potential?
That's a very vague question.
All right, then I'll make it more specific. In your experience of the unknown, what potential have you realized?
I'm not sure. Lots of doubt.
Doubt. Is it a valuable doubt or problematic?
Problematic.
What tells you it's problematic?
Constructive criticism or concern creates solutions.
Right.
Doubt creates confusion.
Right.
So they may feel similar, but their outcomes are different.
Right. Yeah, very good awareness of yourself there. Nice to hear.
I can give more theology if you want.
No. The Dharma world says, I'd like to hear a response. Small doubt, small awakening. Medium-sized doubt, medium-sized awakening. Big doubt, big awakening. What's your response?
I have to give you some theology.
As long as it's coming from you and not from Jerusalem.
Well, I don't know. It's not actually something I believe in, but it's the thing that comes up. So there's a. So.
Go on. Tell me what comes up. Go on, I'm curious.
So there's a very old, traditional, very simplistic model.
Yes.
Which I don't think reflects the universe, but it exists in Judaism of the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. The Yetzer Hara would be traditionally translated as the evil inclination, but you could also say the inclination towards destructiveness.
Yes.
All right. And Yetzer HaTov would be the inclination towards good or constructiveness.
All right.
So within this tradition, there's a saying, the bigger the Yetzer HaTov, the bigger the Yetzer Hara, meaning that the more sort of potential you have, or the more good that you do in the world, the more resistance there will be and the more difficulties that you will have to deal with.
Mm. Yeah. And that is the challenge and part of the exploration. So if you're going to experience the unknown and inquire into it and to question lots of standpoints and beliefs, as the previous person was asking about, and many other things, it does, as a nice quote you gave, generate a potential. And that potential means we have, if we're going to express it, then sometimes we have to face and deal with the polar opposites to it. Like if we can't take the heat, don't go near the fire.
Indeed.
Yeah. And times of the unknown are always pregnant with possibility. And you're part of our practice. So, and sometimes that's coming out of doubt. Small doubt, small awakening, etc. So sometimes there's doubt, we feel we really have to make a change. It's a real risk for us there. We may have to bear with some anxiety and uncertainty. It's still worth living through. And sometimes something really emerges which is much deeper than our problem with the unknown. Good.
You, when you said trust in the mystery, you could say thank you at any point.
I know, I never forget.
You also, so you said one can think of it as trusting the mystery or as loving the mystery.
Yeah, yes.
Can you elaborate on the latter?
A little bit.
And then
because
I'll,
love.
I'll leave you alone.
Thank you. It's a sign of love in this case.
Yes.
In kind of looking at things deeply and as clearly as possible, because love is the wonderful and powerful human force, it's the precious element that human beings can explore with life. It's a transcendent element. It can go anywhere, into any situation, great or small, beautiful or ugly. Love can manifest itself. The challenge in terms of what we're exploring, can I explore a love for the unknown? Can I actually begin to love the unknown? Love the challenge of it. Not to be too much in the absolutes and in the certainties. And that's where mystery, and there is a certain mystery with life, and the unknown is there, but not to make an absolute out of that. And sometimes the mystics have come to the result, life is mysterium tremendum. So life is made into an absolute mystery. It's a profound experience. It can be a living with the unknown. There's much to be said for that, but we also have the potential to really see and know and be awake and not conclude life is just a mystery.
Mm.
We can go deeper than that.
Thank you.
Thank you. So a couple of quiet minutes and then one more invitation. Yes, anyone, at any time, and remembering that both genders are here. Ah, nice. Yes.
So in gender matter.
Can you need to put the microphone.
I will speak in Hebrew.
You speak in Hebrew.
Then I can translate myself.
And they still like to hear the Hebrew
okay.
at the back.
In Hebrew. בעברית. אני רק רוצה להגיד משפט אחד שמציק לי כבר מלפני יומיים. הערה שלא אמרתי במפגש הקודם, שהפריע לי שנושא הנשים היפות שמסתובבות כאן. הרגשתי שזה לא מתאים לי לשמוע את זה. והצטערתי שלא אמרתי את זה אז. לא מנסה לתקן את העבר, זה עדיין חי בי. תודה.
Very clear.
What I said is that it referring to 2 days ago when the words been said about the beautiful women walking around here.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
It troubled me
mm-hmm.
much.
Mm-hmm.
I regret that I didn't say a word then.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm saying it now.
All right.
That's all.
Okay. Thank you. Quiet a minute, another invitation. Yes, anyone, anytime.
אני צריכה תרגום. התכוונתי לקום ואחר כך אמרתי אני לא יקום, אבל בגלל שקמת אז אני קמתי. בערך שנתיים שאני מסתכלת על עצמי במראה ואני לא מכירה את עצמי בכלל, אני רואה כאילו אישה אחרת שאני לא מכירה אותה, ואני רוצה לדבר על החוסר ביטחון שלי דווקא ביופי. שאני מרגישה ש...
It's been 2 years that I'm looking at myself in the mirror and
yes.
I don't recognize who I see.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to speak about the insecurity
mm-hmm.
and actually around the issue of beauty.
Mm.
עד לפני שנתיים יכולתי, אני הרגשתי עם המון המון ביטחון בנושא. לא כל כך הייתי עסוקה אם גברים מסתכלים עליי או לא מסתכלים עליי. אני הסתכלתי על כולם והתאהבתי בכולם. זה אחד הבעיה שלי.
Until 2 years ago I wasn't concerned with the issue. I felt secure and confident, and I wasn't concerned whether men look at me or not. I was looking at all of them and falling in love with all of them, and that was one of the problems.
אני מתאהבת מאוד בקלות. וזה אולי נשמע מצחיק, אבל בבחינתי זה ממש לא מצחיק. אני מרגישה שזה סוג של כלא. אני פתאום מרגישה בת 14, מסתובבת כל הזמן, ומאוד מאוד עסוקה אם גברים מסתכלים עליי או לא מסתכלים עליי, אם הם חושבים שאני יפה או לא יפה, מושכת, לא מושכת, ואני מרגישה שזה משהו יותר מדי.
And now, what, the last 2 years?
Yeah.
Suddenly I'm feeling like I'm 14 years old, and I'm concerned whether men look at me or don't, whether they think I'm beautiful or not, whether they think I'm attractive or not.
Yeah.
And it feels like prison.
Yeah.
And אני עוד כמה חודשים בת 50, ויש לי ילדה מדהימה, בת 25, מאוד 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 יפה. ועם כל עם כל האהבה שיש לי אליה, יש לי פחד לראות את היופי הזה. יש לי פחד שמישהו נכנס הביתה, זה לבר לא בשבילי, זה בשבילה. אני צריכה לשים את עצמי קצת הצידה, ואני עושה את זה, לפעמים יותר בקלות, לפעמים פחות בקלות.
In a few months, I'm going to be 50, and I have a wonderful daughter at the age of 25. She's very, very beautiful. And I'm starting to feel when men come into the house that now they're coming for her and not for me. And I need to put myself aside. And I do it sometimes more, it's more easily, and sometimes less.
Yes, yes.
זה מפחיד אותי.
It scares me.
מאוד. אני מרגישה בסוג של אבל, עם משהו שהיה לי ואין לי אותו יותר, או יש לי אותו בצורה אחרת. מבחינתי זה להיכנס ללא נודע, איפה שאני נמצאת עכשיו.
It scares me. And I feel I'm in mourning and grief. I'm grieving. And
מבחינתי זה לא נודע.
And for me I consider it as being in the unknown.
Yes,
yeah. And אני מדמיינת את עצמי, אם אני מסתכלת אחורה, אני לא הייתי רוצה לחזור אחורה. יש לי חופש פנימי שלא היה לי בגיל 20 בצד אחד. בצד שני יש פער מאוד גדול בין החופש הפנימי שאני מרגישה כאישה והחיצוניות שהיא כבר לא של אישה צעירה, ועצוב לי על זה מאוד, יותר מדי.
when I look back, I don't miss being young.
No.
I have now inner freedom that I didn't have when I was in my 20s. But the inner freedom doesn't compensate for the change in the look.
No.
And I find it very sad.
Yes.
I'm sad about that.
Yeah.
Women's problem.
Not only.
Half of the population.
אני מדברת על זה כאישה. אני מאוד נהנית לראות אנשים יפים, ואני יודעת את כל התיאוריה שיופי חיצוני הוא לא רק... אני גם... בקיצור, יש לי בעיה עם זה מאוד גדולה, ואני לא רוצה
כשאני רואה את הבת בת 25 ויש עוד אחד בת 15 שגם לא חסר לה ועוד כמה בדרך ויש לי קנאה, יש לי פשוט קנאה וקשה לי עם זה נורא, כי זה לא קשור אל הדאל, זה קשור אליי.
When I see my daughter who was 25 and then another daughter who was 15 and also beautiful and the other children, and it's very difficult for me and I feel jealous.
Yeah.
I feel this jealousy and it's a big problem for me.
מספיק אני חושבת.
Firstly, much appreciation for the openness and the sharing and the honesty with your voice. It's a very common, it's a very, you need it's a very, very common voice. And I hear it, in my family with my daughter and her mother, the same voice. I hear it regularly on retreats and on various meetings there. The exploration and the looking into beauty, I think it's one of the most important, a very important discourse, a very important dialogue that we need to have about what is beauty. And because it affects us, our feelings, as you, and unfortunately we have become prisoners to the stereotype of beauty. We've limited beauty to a certain appearance, to certain shapes, to certain ages, and that's become the emotional and mental construct about what beauty is. And we shouldn't underestimate the impact that all of these conceptions and stereotypes have on all of us. And it's become very harmful and destructive in terms of human relationships. And as I mentioned a couple of nights ago, it can go in one direction, prisoner to the conception of beauty in a particular way, and that can affect feelings, thoughts, words, manipulations, all of that can come in. And to repeat, we need some dialogue to open up what beauty is. And the reason that we need the dialogue is because beauty has a transcendent element to it. We can see the beauty in the person. And on a retreat, we all arrive as, most of us, as strangers to each other. We hardly know each other. We hardly notice each other, and yet as the days pass by and as we get closer to each other, the appreciations, we begin to see the beauty of different people in all sorts of ways, and that begins to stand out for us. And when that's opening out for us in a whole variety of ways, both men and women, when that's opening out for us, we're actually beginning to get a sense of a transcendent beauty.
Hold on, I'm holding Yofi. Yofi transcendental. Is it going? What do you mean by transcendental? Going beyond the beauty?
There's in the relationship to others. We can see beauty, and yet if we looked in the most ordinary of way, etc., we could say, "Oh, this is just a person. This is just a man. This is just a woman." Whatever. But sometimes, when the full attention is there and the presence, the beauty begins to come through. And authentic beauty, genuine beauty, carries with it the element of love. It belongs to that realm. When we lose contact with the transcendent element of beauty and love, the comparing starts. One has just identified oneself with corporate advertising.
What?
Which? All right.
No.
She says maybe we should change the subject.
It's not the subject. It's the method. I continue.
Okay, yeah.
All right.
No, it's important.
Just beauty. The beauty of the painting. The beauty of the artist's work. The beauty of the flower. The beauty of the man, the woman, and child. That, as it were, what's out there has the potential to communicate something greater than itself. It's not just a piece of paint on a board. It's speaking to us of something which transcends the material. This transcendent of the material we call beauty. We call love. And sometimes we are touched. It could be in the theatre. It could be in the form of the art. It could be in the presence of another person. And it's not just about the form, the shape, the colour, the materials, the body. And this transcendent element is deeply precious in life. When we understand it well, the stereotype of comparing, in your case, through aging, that begins to drop away. It's the conditionality, because of the media, I feel, has the advertising, the persuasions of using sex and using age, often teenagers, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, or whatever, and making a stereotype out of that. And of course, the tragic and sad consequences that as men and women get older, they feel they're aging more, they have an idea, I'm losing my beauty, and they're pinpointing the beauty elsewhere. It isn't easy to recognize the beauty which belongs to all of us, which can be shared with all of us, and to love and trust in that. We become, as I said, and as you said, we become prisoners. The young become prisoners to it as well, and the constant effort and attempt to appear beautiful. And the old become prisoners because there is a view, I had it, and now I don't have it. Beauty is a transcendent element. It's not about the state of the body. It's not about that. Don't buy it. Jealousy is comparing. Jealousy is saying, you have something, I don't have it. Jealousy is saying, you're getting more attention than me. Jealousy is saying, you're better off than I am. And in that, we lose love and appreciation and the beauty of a maturing life, the beauty of more wisdom and kindness in life, the beauty of aging. You need to be comfortable with beauty.
What do you say then? Is that there's hope? She's asking if you're saying if there's hope. Of course. Look at him.
There's the exploration of beauty. We threw away the word hope 3 days ago. No? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I have a couple of minutes and then I'll just skip the general reflection. In the context of the situation, I fully agree with Iran on questions of future and long-term future. I can say, yes, it doesn't matter. Because so much priority is given here between us to look at what's unfolding here and now. And that exploration of the processes that we have plenty to engage in, plenty to experience and to look into, and we do need to keep that as a priority. But sometimes it does emerge, and as you rightly reminded us, that sometimes the larger unfoldment of life does raise questions, and we are human beings, and we have obviously the perfect right to ask those questions, and to explore our whatever understanding there may be, or it may be one of the major unknowns for us, but at least we raise the questions. And to look at this experience of life and death and our relationship to the whole event and what we feel and think about this whole process and the various views, philosophical, religious, scientific, which we are exposed to, and how our inner responses are, how we might interpret various experiences which come and make some impact upon us. And as we touching upon as well, in terms of the unknown, it's sometimes when people are in the midst of the unknown, and it's an extremely difficult time, sometimes our well-intentionality is to want to tell the other, whoever she or he may be, what they should be doing. And perhaps our more loving and supportive voice is actually to let the person, give them support, to trust in the process of things, and that something may flower and may emerge out of it. And in many areas, in the areas of creativity I have in mind here, in the areas of significant change, we really have to learn to be steady for a while. I mean, if I just take one example of a fairly obvious example of what I mean, that there was this huge banking financial crisis we saw a year or two back. And instead of actually making some time for some meditation and some reflection and some looking at what happened, there in Wall Street and from the White House and from the UK, I think in the United States, they threw $700 billion at the banking system and just to bring public confidence back and just set the whole same problem back in motion all over again. Instead of saying, look, this is a crisis, clearly the system that we're living in isn't working, instead of having some patience, some thoughtful people putting some silence and quietness and reflection, inquiry and working together, some other whole healthy nourishing method which challenges all the greed that could come in, maybe many, many small banks, a whole different way of the banking system. No, we have to be seen to do something. Sometimes we need to see this has failed, this is a disaster. People's life savings have been lost, millions of people's homes have been affected and lost. It's a terrible crisis. We have to stop, we have to be still, we have to inquire, we have to see if something new can come out of us, which shows a more caring and compassionate relationship and challenges the greed and the selfishness and the rotten corruption in our system. And this is what we mean by being with the unknown. It's a stepping back, looking again, giving some time and space, being patient, and something of the best can come out of us. And similarly with the artist, I sometimes think of one of the great poets, of which poetry, to its great credit, it's a wonderful poetry about the profound transcendental nature of beauty. You can find it in the poets and in the playwrights. And sometimes in the poetry, like Rilke, he just stopped writing poetry. He just stopped. He just waited. And in allowing himself to wait there, out of the waiting, a sudden burst of extraordinary, the Duane energy just burst out of him. Sometimes we need space, we need to be in the unknown, to allow something deep, a creative force to come through, to move through us and to find its actualization. The unknown is precious. It's precious. It's men and women who have been willing, and the great men, women and men on this earth, and it's another expression of great beauty as well, of women and men who have been willing to say no to the past, to say no to how it is, I've been willing to step outside of that box and wait and see and cooperate, and something fresh can come out of it. And truth and liberation always has a break with problematic history. It's the nature of truth. It breaks with the problematic of the past. And that's a great challenge for us, because we like to identify so much with the past. And when we identify so much with it, we live in it. We become the prisoner of it. Instead of it being our friend and our servant, we become a prisoner to it. And the unknown is a precious element for human life. And important too, of course, to bring up and to have the freedom, as you expressed, the freedom to listen and to say, what I heard made me feel uncomfortable. Important that women and men have this freedom of expression, have this freedom to share and to communicate. Much of the problems of life is when things stay in the unspoken. When we are afraid to speak up, when we're afraid to share the voice. And that movement, and it's one of the great movements of life, from the unspoken into the spoken. Things can be looked at and shared and discussed together, seriously and with humour and with light and with inquiry, and to bring all of that together. And it is, I feel, an ongoing dialogue, especially with beauty and the way it's become corrupted, the way it's become stereotyped into a certain kind of person, the way she or he looks. And that's a terrible corruption of what beauty is all about. And we have to liberate beauty as much as we have to liberate love. We have to find out what beauty really is in a much deeper way than the one that we've been told. And that's also part of our engagement. Thank you, everybody, for listening.